Hey foodies! Many of us can appreciate the role that terroir has on the unique flavor and aroma of our foods. Whether you enjoy coffee, tea, or even chocolate, the region from which it's harvested can play a big impact on your flavor experience. And just like these commodity crops, other botanical ingredients can feature unique chemistries and flavors when grown and harvested in different environments. Moreover, the means of processing these ingredients and the travel time from farm to your kitchen cabinet can really matter when it comes to the flavor of the final product. So in this episode of Foodie Pharmacology, I got the chance to speak with Ethan Frisch, who works to bring unique spices from around the world to the dinner table. Ethan is an entrepreneur and activist around food systems and social justice. He has worked in kitchens as a line cook and pastry chef in New York and London, and as a chef behind Gorilla Ice Cream. He left the kitchens to become a humanitarian aid worker and worked with NGOs, including the Aga Khan Foundation in Afghanistan, Maria Stopes in Sierra Leone, and Doctors Without Borders on the Syrian and Jordanian border. Ethan co-founded Burlap and Barrel with Ori Zohar, and he leads Burlap and Barrel's sourcing, importing, and international logistics, as well as supply relationships with restaurants and manufacturers across North America. He is also an adjunct chef instructor at the Institute for Culinary Education in New York City. Burlap and Barrel is a public benefit corporation, building new international food supply chains that are equitable, transparent, and traceable. Their public benefit is to promote the reduction of inequality and exploitation in food systems by connecting farmers to high-value markets, helping them access a larger share of the product value chain, and establishing long-term, mutually beneficial trade relationships. They measure social impact both at origin in their sourcing practices and at home in their support for organizations that are doing great work related to food, culture, identity, and community. To date, they've paid their partner farmers more than $150,000 at rates significantly higher than commodity prices. Ethan joined me over Skype to discuss some of the exciting work underway at Burlap and Barrel. I hope that you enjoy our chat as much as I did. Well, hey, Ethan, it's great to have you on this show. Thanks so much for agreeing to come on.
Thanks for having me. It's great to join you.
Thanks. Well, why don't we start by telling us a little bit about yourself? I know that you've been engaged in a lot of really exciting entrepreneurial activities around the food business.
Yeah. So I'm a chef and the co-founder of Burlap and Barrel. We are a single origin spice company and actually the only single origin, comprehensive single origin spice company in the United States. We work with smallholder farmers in a dozen countries, mostly farmers who've never exported before. So we set them up to export, help with all of the things that go into that process, which we can talk more deeply about. And then we import their spices into the U.S. for the first time. And we carry them on our website. We supply a lot of restaurants. And because we have these direct relationships with producers, we get really interesting spices that other companies can't source.
That's awesome. So how did you go from this journey of being a chef into running a business?
Yeah, it was a long journey and often not clear where I was going or how I was getting there. But I left kitchens to go to graduate school for international development. I wanted to be an aid worker and ultimately moved to Afghanistan, where I lived for a couple of years working for a big nonprofit. I was working on an infrastructure project, rural infrastructure, building schools, some roads and bridges and clinics and other projects throughout really remote rural areas of the northeast of Afghanistan, way up in the mountains. Mm. And while I was spending time in that part of the country, which I was spending quite a bit of time in that part of the country, I came across a variety of wild cumin that grows up in the mountains that is well known within Afghanistan as being very high quality, having a really distinctive flavor and aroma, but is not really known outside the country at all. And I started bringing it home, not as a business, just for fun. I was so excited about this ingredient that I had never tasted before, that I wanted to share it with people in the restaurant industry, friends who I had cooked with. And so I started smuggling it home in duffel bags in increasing quantities as the response grew. And I was just really blown away by how enthusiastic my friends in the business were about this ingredient. And I I, you know, these are chefs at some of the best restaurants in the country who theoretically would have access to any ingredient they could possibly imagine, but they didn't have access to this one thing that I, knowing really very little about the whole industry, was able to, you know, bring back in a suitcase. So that's where the original idea came from. Recognizing that there were smallholder producers around the world growing something really special, but who didn't have the access to international markets to sell it at its full value.
Yeah.
And there were people here, home cooks and professional chefs, who really appreciated the diversity and intensity of those ingredients and wanted to try cooking with them.
That's amazing. Was this a wild cumin, or was it being cultivated by local people in the mountains?
So it is a wild cumin. There are parts of Afghanistan where they do cultivate the same variety, but the one that we get is the wild harvested cumin. It grows in Badakhshan, which is a province in the northeast of the country. It's the Latin name is Bunium persicum, sometimes called Persian cumin or black cumin. It's also cultivated in other places in India and Pakistan. They grow it, but the wild version, I think, tastes so much better.
Yeah.
And it's picked by shepherds out in the mountains with their sheep towards the end of the summer, kind of mid to late August, sometimes into early September. It's a very short harvest season because it's very high elevation and gets cold pretty quickly. And so the shepherds out in the mountains will pick cumin as they walk with their sheep and bring it back down to the city in that province called Faizabad. And I have a couple of friends, people I worked with really closely when I lived there, who collect it and truck it down through more mountains down to Kabul and then ship it to New York. And it's a crazy supply chain.
That's amazing. Yeah.
But, yeah.
I've run into things so similar to this in my work in the Mediterranean and the Balkans, too. These wild, fragrant herbal ingredients that are included in foods are just so incredible in flavor because it comes down to the plant's chemistry.
Yeah.
Those wild species are defending themselves from all the things that they have to deal with in the wild. They're not being, you know, pampered with herbicides and pesticides,
yeah,
or fertilizers and so on. So they have their own unique chemistry. That's fantastic. In southern Italy, there's a special kind of oregano that I've gone out with local people to collect. It's called Oreganum heracleticum. And this stuff is like no oregano you've ever tasted. It's so fragrant. So I can imagine that this Persian cumin is probably along the same lines of that level of just amazing flavor.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So you go from this this kind of beginning of getting past the USDA, I'm assuming,
yeah,
in the early stages. Now I know you've got all your permits and things lined up.
Right.
And so how did you go from starting this supply chain in Afghanistan? I know you're working in many different parts of the world. So why don't you, like, how many different countries is Burlap and Barrel engaged with when it comes to supplying these unique ingredients?
Yeah, the theory was pretty early on that if we could figure out how to export from Afghanistan, which is a pretty challenging country to export from and import from,
yeah,
as well, if we could figure out how to do that, we could probably figure out how to export and import from other countries as well. And so we went to Zanzibar. I had a friend who was working on a coffee export project from Zanzibar, and she had met a co-op growing spices and knew that they wanted to do their own exporting and just hadn't found an import partner at the other end of the chain to work with. And this has been pretty true across the board. We often meet farmers who've had this idea on their own, who recognize the problems with the commodity market in spices, but just have not figured out how to reach the United States or how to reach an international market directly themselves. And so we started working with the co-op in Zanzibar. We get beautiful black pepper, really spicy, really lemony black pepper, cloves, nutmeg, cinnamon. And then we met a farmer in Guatemala growing cardamom, which I know is one of your favorites.
Yes.
and I met him through a nonprofit that was working with cardamom farmers, mostly very smallholder farmers all throughout central Guatemala. And I got in touch with them and asked, who's the best one? Who should I talk to? And they said, come meet this guy. So I flew down to Guatemala and spent a week or so with him. And we've now been working with him for more than 3 years.
That's amazing. Yeah, I was surprised that Guatemala is actually a major producer of cardamom. I learned about that when I was investigating it for the episode on cardamom. I think what's coming across that's really fascinating to me is that your unusual path of understanding flavor in your chef's training, plus your work in international aid, really has fostered this really fascinating trajectory for the business.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely the combination of the two. And then the other critically important element is my business partner, Ori Zohar, who is an experienced entrepreneur and knows how to run a business effectively. And so between the two of us, we've got some of the skills that we need to make this happen. But I think that's, I think the partnership aspect of it is so important. There are so many food entrepreneurs who are really good at food, who are, have a really deep expertise in the flavor and the culinary aspect of what they do. But running a business requires an entirely different skill set. Not one that I could do on my own, and one that I think a lot of food entrepreneurs either underestimate or just don't realize how important it's going to be as a business grows.
That's great. Well, I know from the local farmers' perspective, as you mentioned, some of the difficulties are getting these really premium, unique and amazingly flavorful ingredients out of rural areas and into global trade. I know from my work in the Balkans, this is a significant hurdle. You have the local smallhold collectors that then sell their goods to middlemen who then sell it to another middleman who then sell it to another person in the country. And yeah. So the passage of goods is really through so many different hands. And in the end, the farmers or the wild crafters that go out and collect these in the wild receive very little in terms of compensation. And I know that this is something that your company really prides itself on is in fostering, the work of the local people. Can you tell us a bit about that, how you've set up these trade networks?
Yeah, absolutely. So you're exactly right that the supply chain is very fragmented. Spices change hands 15 to 50 times before they've even left the country of origin. Mm-hmm. So smallholder farmers sell to a truck driver, or they sell to somebody with a little storage room in the back of a shop. And that person is buying from a dozen or a couple of dozen individual farmers. And then that person is selling on to somebody with a bigger truck and a bigger warehouse. And you have essentially a funnel effect with a lot of smallholder farmers at the top and a couple of big exporters at the bottom who ultimately make the most money and control the flow of the product that they're exporting. And there are many downsides to that process, not least of them being farmers don't make nearly as much money as other people later on in the supply chain. And the farmers who are initiating the supply chain, who have the really deep expertise in how to grow what they grow, who we assume should be making the most money in this process, really, really are left out of the financial aspect of exporting and selling spices. So that's just sort of deeply unequal and unfair, and we're working to fix that. And then the other downsides are that when farmers are doing something different or growing something special, whether it's the variety or the way that they process the spice after it's harvested, the way that it's dried, something about the terroir or the climate of an individual farm, all of that gets lost because one farmer's lot is getting mixed with their neighbor and somebody else potentially hundreds of miles away with a very different product. Mm-hmm. Big spice companies are optimizing for consistency, for quantity over quality. And so they don't care that actually they even prefer not to get you something unique or special. They want you to receive a spice that's sort of uniform. And that's a shame. And then the third problem is that process just takes a very long time. It can take 3 years or more for spices to get from the farm to the supermarket.
Wow. And then everybody's losing flavor along the way, I imagine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And everybody's guilty of, you know, having a spice in the back of their kitchen cupboard that they haven't touched in years. So you know, you're holding onto it for years, but it took years to get to that point. And yeah, losing flavor, a lot of the nuance, a lot of what made that agricultural product special is gone by the time it actually arrives in your kitchen. And I think the work that's being done in the coffee industry and the tea industry is setting a great precedent. People are starting to understand a little more about the importance of single origin, the importance of direct supply chains. That just hasn't been applied to spices before.
Well, anyone that's appreciated a cup of coffee from a certain region or a wine grown in a certain region, I mean, it's the same principle that applies here when it comes to spices. Yeah. Well, I think what would be interesting maybe, Ethan, is if you can walk us through a specific example. I know you've done a lot of work with black pepper, and you mentioned its amazing lemony fragrance in some of the more freshly harvested on black pepper. Can you tell us a bit about your work with that spice?
Yeah, absolutely. So black pepper may be the most common spice in the American kitchen on you know, every table at every restaurant in the country. But most people have no idea that it is even an agricultural product, let alone how it grows or what it looks like on the plant. Mm-hmm. So black pepper is actually a fruit. It grows in bunches like little tiny grapes on a climbing vine. It's native. There's some debate about this, but it's native to either southern India or southern Indonesia, to Sumatra, where it's been cultivated in both places for many thousands of years, and obviously has been transported all around the world for a very long time.
Yeah.
When you look at a black peppercorn, a whole black peppercorn, there are roughly two elements of the peppercorn, two parts of the peppercorn that are worth pointing out. One is the skin, what looks black, the wrinkly, dried skin of the peppercorn, which is actually the dried fruit, which has shriveled up and turned dark like a raisin. And that's where you get a lot of the flavor complexity, the fruity notes, the savory notes, the lemony notes. Most of those are going to be in the dried fruit of the peppercorn. And then the other part of the peppercorn is the interior of the peppercorn, the white pepper. So when you buy white peppercorns, what you're actually buying is just the pit of the peppercorn with the fruit stripped off of it. And that's where the piperine is concentrated, and piperine is the compound that makes pepper spicy. Mm-hmm. So heat is concentrated in the pit of the peppercorn. So those are kind of the two parts of the peppercorn. As pepper ripens on the vine, it starts out green. I mean, actually, we should start earlier than that. The plant shoots out these threads, and along the thread, there are tiny little white flowers. The flowers are pollinated by the rain. So a drop of rain running down the thread, running down the stalk, will pollinate some or all of the flowers on that stalk. And that's where the pepper starts. As the fruit develops, it starts out as a green fruit and then turns yellow and ultimately red when it's ripe. 99%, the overwhelming majority of pepper sold in the United States was picked underripe, was picked when it was green. And that dates back hundreds of years to a time when peppercorns being transported halfway or all the way around the world needed to sit in the hold of a ship, not the ideal condition for storing food. And so people started picking their peppercorns underripe because the sharpness that you get in an underripe fruit carries through much more clearly than any of the nuanced flavors that you get as the fruit ripens. Those kind of dry out or evaporate out in the potentially year that it took the pepper to travel in a humid, really not ideal environment.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of other reasons that farmers pick their peppercorns underripe. They're harder. They're physically harder, the peppercorns, so they don't bruise as easily. They dry faster because there's less moisture. The sugars haven't developed in the fruit, so there's less risk of fermentation or rotting. But the downside is that you miss out on a lot of the complexity of flavor and nuance that you get from a vine ripened black pepper. So I've been to pepper farms in probably 10 countries, a dozen different countries.
Wow.
And to a lot of different pepper farms rather in all of those countries.
Are these mainly kind of tropical areas where it grows?
Yeah, exactly. So you can grow pepper. You can grow pepper as an indoor plant. You can grow it in your home. There are places where they grow pepper in greenhouses. The most part, the majority of the world's pepper comes from Brazil and Vietnam. Hmm. India grows huge quantities. Indonesia grows huge quantities. But Brazil, I don't remember the statistics off the top of my head, but Brazil is one of the only places where pepper production has been mechanized. Everywhere else, it's grown on very small farms, smallholder farmers who are doing everything manually. Peppercorns are picked by hand, dried in the sun. Sometimes there's a very rudimentary machine that spins them around and pulls the peppercorns themselves off of the stalk. But it's a very manual, very tactile process.
Okay, yeah.
And so the two that we carry, just as an example of kind of two different types of peppercorns, one is from Zanzibar. It's picked about halfway through the ripening process, which they do to find a middle ground between the spicy intensity that you get from an underripe pepper and the more fruity nuance that you get from a ripened pepper. So it's a really nice balance of very spicy and very lemony. It really has a lemon zest aroma and flavor. And one of the other reasons I think that it comes out so spicy is that Zanzibar is not really the ideal environment for growing black pepper. The soil is too sandy, it's too dry, it's too windy. It grows in very hilly jungles on the island of Pemba, which is in the Zanzibar archipelago. And as a result, the plants have to work pretty hard, the sandy soil, the heat, the wind. You wind up with a pepper that has had to struggle to survive. And you taste that in the intensity of the peppercorn, which is pretty remarkable. It just won a gold medal, actually, from a European chef's tasting panel.
It's amazing. Stressed out plants make the best food. Amazing.
Then the other pepper that we get comes from Vietnam, a very small farm. These two guys, business partners, who I met a year ago when we went to Vietnam to visit pepper farmers. And they're really special because Vietnam produces huge volumes of low quality commodity black pepper. And most of the farmers that we met are growing in that style. As a climbing vine, peppercorns need something to climb up. And in really high quality pepper, they'll climb up a living tree because the vine actually does draw nutrients from the tree itself. But in commodity pepper, farmers are stacking concrete blocks or using bamboo stakes or something to let the peppercorn vines climb up. So what these two guys are doing in a context of purely commodity pepper cultivation, where every other farmer around them is using pesticides and herbicides and using these concrete blocks to support their pepper vines. Really good black pepper needs to be supported by a living tree in order to produce the highest quality, best flavor pepper. The vine itself draws nutrients from the tree that it's climbing. And so when farmers use bamboo stakes or stacks of concrete blocks, which is pretty common in Vietnam, they're missing out on a lot of the complexity and flavor that you'd get from vines climbing a living tree. Yeah. So we're working with a small farm in central Vietnam, an area called Dak Lak. These two really young guys, both in their early 20s, who looked at what all of their neighbors were doing and said, there has to be a better way. Yeah. And so they have a beautiful pepper farm with these very tall nitrogen-fixing trees that they planted. And the vines will go up 20 or 30 feet up the tree. They graze chickens and ducks around the base of the vines to provide some natural organic fertilizer. It's just an idyllic, beautiful farm. You walk through these columns of pepper vines. It's like being in the ruins of an ancient temple or something.
Wow.
These columns climbing up into the sky.
You must get to travel a lot, it sounds like. How do you get connected with all these unique farms?
All kinds of ways. That's one of the most fun parts of doing this, is traveling to visit partner farmers, either longstanding friends who we've been working with for a few years or new relationships that we're trying to start. And we meet farmers in all kinds of ways. Sometimes we meet them through local friends or contacts, people who've spent time in those countries. Sometimes we meet them through nonprofits who work with farmers. Other times we meet them through local government agencies. In Vietnam, we spent 2 days in two different parts of the country with local government officials whose job it is to bring investment into the rural communities that they work in. So it's all kinds of ways, but most of the farmers we meet ultimately are not going to be a fit for us. Either what they're growing is not distinct enough, not unique enough, not high quality enough, or they just don't want to work with us. I mean, we see the commodity model as being fundamentally flawed, but for a lot of farmers, it's reliable, it's consistent, it's what they've been doing for a very long time, and they may not want to change that, and that's absolutely their prerogative.
Yeah.
But the best relationships are the ones that start by us showing up on a farm and the farmer going, "What the hell took you so long? I've been waiting for somebody like you to show up for years." And so a kind of entrepreneurial profile, a farmer who is pushing the limits both in terms of what they grow and how they hope to sell their products, those wind up being the best partners for us.
And so when you establish a partnership, what happens next? Do you basically set expectations for how much you'll buy by weight, or they ship directly to you, or how do those kinds of agreements with local farmers in all these different countries, how do those start?
Yeah. The most important thing for me is making sure that a farmer understands the supply chain that they're initiating, because the fact of the matter is that just like most cooks don't know anything about where their spices came from, most spice farmers have no idea where their spices go when they leave the farm. They sell to the truck driver and that's it. That's the end of it for them.
Yeah.
So another aspect of it is the price conversation, which is really important. And this is, it's different for different plants. They, you know, there are different ways that obviously spices grow since they're all different plants. And so in some cases, a farmer by growing a specific variety or using specific techniques is able to grow an entire lot that's better than what anybody else is able to grow. Mm-hmm. But in other cases, they grow a range of qualities. And so sometimes we can buy everything that they grow. And sometimes we wind up buying only a pretty small percentage of the best of their best stuff. And we buy that at a significant premium, you know, anywhere from twice to 10 times what the commodity market might pay for their spices. So they can make a lot more money by working with us. But ultimately they also get a lot more control, which to me and hopefully to them is also very important, that they get to decide how they grow, what they want to grow, how they sell it, how much they sell it for. So the partnership conversations start with me pulling up our website and showing them, this is how we are selling your product. Here are some pictures of dishes that chefs are making with your spices or making with similar spices. This is where your product is going to end up.
Wow.
Here's how much we sell it for, because that can be a challenging conversation to have.
Yeah.
For a smallholder farmer in Vietnam who to see that we're selling a jar of peppercorns for $7 or $8, which in the US isn't that much, but to a farmer in Vietnam, that can seem like a pretty significant amount of money. Yeah. So it's really important that we contextualize it for them. So we break that cost down very specifically. Here's how much we pay for our glass jar. This is what we pay for the label and the lid and all of the steps, all of the processes that go into creating a finished product. So that they understand how honest we are about this.
Yeah,
that
we're not totally take it transparent. Yeah.
Exactly. And then we go through that same process for them. What are their costs? Do they need to hire people during the harvest season to help with the picking? What are the inputs that they're putting into their farm? Are they buying organic fertilizers? Are they, just what are their costs in running the, in running their business? And usually what happens is that a price emerges pretty clearly in the middle that works for them and works for us. And that's where we settle. That's been the case across, you know, we work in a dozen different countries, a lot of farms, in some cases individual farmers, and in some cases co-ops or associations of farmers. But we've been able to apply that process of complete transparency and honesty and just setting the relationship up on a really strong foundation of trust from the very beginning. And that's carried through.
What's the chef world's response to this? I can imagine, as we mentioned earlier, there's an appreciation for terroir when it comes to where your coffee is grown, where your chocolate is grown, where a lot of these other, you know, tea and so on. What's been the response so far with chefs? I know that you're based in New York. Have you had much of a response in Manhattan?
Yeah. The crazy thing, you know, having worked as a chef myself, and I cooked at a high-end Indian restaurant in New York called Tabla, Danny Meyer and Floyd Cardo's restaurant, pretty high profile. I thought I knew my way around a spice cabinet. Mm-hmm. And it really wasn't until I moved to Afghanistan that I realized that I had no idea how spices grew, where they come from. And that has been true even with some of the most expert chefs at some of the best restaurants in the country. They just have not really thought about cinnamon as tree bark or peppercorns as a fruit on a vine. So, while chefs definitely appreciate quality, they don't know very much, just like home cooks don't know very much about where spices come from. So the process of education has been a big part of what we do, mm-hmm. Both on the professional side and on the home cook side of the business. But we work with a lot of great restaurants. We supply 11 Madison Park and Blue Hill, Chez Panisse in Berkeley. Hundreds of restaurants across the country, because the quality really speaks for itself. When you get it's the difference between biting into a beautiful, fresh farmer's market apple that came from a local orchard versus buying something, you know, at the grocery store that's been sitting around in a shipping container for a very long time and was shipped in from Ecuador and was picked a year ago and covered in wax. And, you know, the we're all familiar with the disappointing red delicious apple that you get at the supermarket. So there's a major flavor difference, and that's really what gets chefs excited.
Yeah. Don't get me started on tomatoes. It's like the same thing. I'm like, can I just please have a real fresh tomato? Because yeah, you're right. I think the time from harvest to market is so important, and the way that it's grown, as you've definitely keyed into. Do you ever kind of do taste tests with chefs to have them run a comparison, or are they just, when they taste these spices, they immediately sense the difference based on their background knowledge?
Yeah, I mean, we do taste tests all the time, but it's pretty apparent when you smell our cinnamon or you taste our cinnamon that it's unlike any cinnamon that I had ever tasted before. The cinnamon that we're getting from Vietnam is an heirloom variety from central Vietnam. Most of the industrially produced cinnamon is grown in the north of the country. And we wound up going to an area in the center of the country, an area called Quang Nam, where everybody had told us, don't bother going. They don't grow any cinnamon there anymore. It's over. Because there was a deep history of growing cinnamon going back thousands of years. And in particular, a variety called royal cinnamon, which was grown to supply the royal court on the coast down the mountains in the city of Hue. But we decided not to listen to the advice, and we went anyway and just had this amazingly eye-opening experience. We got out of the car at a farm where they were harvesting cinnamon, maybe a quarter mile away, up a hill, in the distance, and we could smell. It smelled like walking into a bakery with cinnamon buns right out of the oven.
Oh my gosh! So strong,
you know, on a farm a quarter mile from where the actual harvesting was taking place. So we knew we were onto something. We wound up negotiating the purchase of a metric ton of the cinnamon that day, standing in the driveway of this. it was pretty ridiculous. I had never been so taken with a spice before that I needed to buy it on the spot. But
that's amazing.
But it just blew me away. And you taste the cinnamon. So cinnamon is tree bark. It's cut from, there are four different species, commercially cultivated species of cinnamon. And then there are a couple of others that aren't grown really commercially. But they all taste pretty different. Each species is generally correlated with a country of origin. So those four countries, and there are other countries obviously that grow cinnamon, but those four countries and the four species are the Sri Lankan variety, the Indonesian variety, the Chinese variety, and the Vietnamese variety. And they taste pretty different. So much so that I think even somebody without a lot of experience tasting cinnamon can pick up on the differences. And the two extremes flavor-wise are the Sri Lankan or the Ceylon variety, Cinnamomum verum, and the Vietnamese variety, Cinnamomum lureroi. Cinnamomum verum, the Ceylon variety, is much more savory, much more herbal, has kind of a citrus or an orange peel character to it, whereas the Vietnamese variety is just hit you over the head, super sweet, super spicy. And so they're very different flavor profiles. And another variable that impacts flavor is the age of the branch that the bark was cut off of. So
really?
Very young branches have a lot more nuance, a lot more subtlety. And very old branches have a lot more intensity. The oils have really concentrated and you just get a much stronger flavor. The problem with the way that we buy cinnamon here in the U.S. is that everybody seems to think that cinnamon sticks are somehow a higher quality than cinnamon powder. And it's definitely true that they would have a longer shelf life. But in order for a cinnamon stick to be cut off the tree and rolled really nicely to make the aesthetic of the cinnamon stick that we look for, it has to be mediocre cinnamon. It has to be too old to get the nuance and complexity of the really young branches and too young to get the intensity of the older branches. So you wind up with something that's really being grown for the aesthetics of it. It's really grown for the appearance of the cinnamon stick rather than for flavor. So bark is cut off of the tree, either off of a branch or off of the trunk. It's allowed to dry in the sun, and that's how you get the curled edges of a cinnamon stick. The bark is being cut off the tree in sheets, and then as it dries, almost like a wet piece of paper might, it curls up. And so when you get a curled cinnamon stick, that's what you're getting. And then the cinnamon stick, you know, even more ridiculous, is always cut down to 7 centimeters long. That's the industry standard. And it's just ridiculous because it's not connected with a farmer's experience of growing it. They don't care how long the cinnamon stick is. And it's not really connected with our experience at home of cooking with a cinnamon stick. It's purely about what fits in the jar, what works for the middleman. It's just an example of how our priorities in spices have been skewed so incorrectly.
Yeah. Well, and by drying it in the sun, you're probably also losing a number of those volatiles. Did you ever observe how local people are using the cinnamon? Do they prepare it differently for their own consumption?
Yeah. So what's really interesting about the spice trade is that in some cases, people are growing spices that they're eating themselves and have been growing in their communities for a very long time. But in other cases, people are growing something purely for export. It's a cash crop and they don't really use it. So in Vietnam, they use a lot of cinnamon. They use a lot of star anise. It goes into, you know, classic Vietnamese dishes like pho, or they'll use it in a lot of savory applications, which I think is unexpected for most Americans who are used to cinnamon being purely a sweet ingredient. Mm-hmm. So cinnamon will go into meat-based stews. And they use other parts of the plant as well. You can use the cinnamon leaves. We carry cinnamon leaves from Zanzibar as a bay leaf alternative. When you pull a leaf off the cinnamon tree, especially the Vietnamese variety, there's a little well of sweet, spicy cinnamon flavor at the base of the leaf. So kids will run around through the woods pulling leaves off the tree and sucking on the base of the leaf.
Oh, cool.
It's like a honeysuckle or something like that. And then interestingly, in Guatemala, where we get our cardamom and where the majority of the world's cardamom comes from, it's purely an export crop. They don't eat it. They don't like it. It has not entered into the local cuisine at all, despite having been grown there for, you know, 140 odd years. It's just remained a purely export crop.
I guess that says something about how when we move plants through the world and they enter into different cultures, yeah, they're not always eagerly adopted in local cuisine. That's interesting.
Yeah. Often they're more valuable to export than they are to cook with. Or sometimes, as is the case in cardamom, there's a drying step, which is almost always done by machine, using a hot air dryer in the way that a lot of producers dry coffee in a raised bed with a hot air pump that pushes hot air underneath the cardamom pods and dries them out. In Guatemala, they're grown in the cloud forest. It's very shady and very humid, and they don't really dry in the sun. There isn't a whole lot of sun to dry them. And the other aspect is that spices are often graded by color. And when you dry something in the sun, it can get a little bleached. And so you lose some value when you dry your product in the sun because the color might not be as dark or intense.
So we've talked about black pepper and cardamom and the Persian cumin. What are some of your other favorite spices that you've brought into the company?
We have some really interesting chili peppers from Turkey. And I just find the travel that the chili pepper has done. It's one of the three major New World spices, along with vanilla and allspice. It's native to the Americas, and there's some debate about where it originally came from. I've read both Bolivia, the highlands of Bolivia, and the highlands of Central Mexico. But it's a New World crop. So any chili peppers used in Indian cooking, Thai cooking, anywhere else in the world, and the whole world pretty much loves chilies. Mm-hmm. That's a fairly recent introduction. That's really just been since the 1500s. Chili pepper seeds were carried back to Europe as the story goes, by Christopher Columbus personally.
Oh.
I went to Spain, to Extremadura, where we source our smoked paprika. And it's one of the places outside of the New World where chili peppers have been grown the longest. It was the first place that they landed when Europeans came back to Europe from the Americas. And the story that they tell is that Christopher Columbus personally carried the seeds of the chili pepper from the Caribbean to Spain, where the seeds were distributed to different monasteries around the country, and different monasteries or different monastic orders bred different styles of chili peppers. And that accounts for some of the differences in flavor that we see today in different paprikas, whether they're sweet or spicy or bittersweet. Those can be from different chili pepper varieties that have been bred for a long time in different parts of Spain. And then chili pepper seeds made their way to India. It's a little unclear whether they went to Turkey, whether they went through the Middle East to get to India, or whether they went to India first and were carried by the Portuguese, or whether they and then came back to Turkey. But regardless, chili peppers are a hugely important element of Turkish cooking. Lots of different varieties, lots of different flavor profiles, sweet and spicy and everything in between. And one of the other things that they do in Turkey that's really interesting, and I haven't seen anywhere else, is a fermentation process, a curing process of a chili pepper. So in an area called Urfa, which is on the Turkish-Syrian border, an ancient city with a biblical history, they grow these bright red, medium hot, sweet chili peppers. Mm-hmm. It's the Aleppo pepper variety, which is its more famous cousin. And they cure the peppers. They take these fresh peppers, they chop them up when they're fresh during the harvest, and they lay them out under plastic sheets in the sun. And it's 110 degrees. It's the desert, so it's really dry. And the peppers just they shrivel up, they sweat, they turn black, and they develop these really incredible chocolate, coffee, raisin, and malt flavors.
Oh wow!
In addition to being a chili, in addition to having some heat, but they're just beautiful, savory, sweet, and spicy.
So you're focused mainly on spices. Have you ever dabbled in the herbal tea trade as well? Or is that something you've thought about for the future? Or are you guys going to really stay focused on quality spices?
I think the thing that I've realized fairly recently is that the definition of a spice is fluid. Mm-hmm. And so for a long time, sugar was considered a spice. It was really expensive. It was hard to get in quantity. It was something that was only grown in very specific parts of the world. And all throughout medieval and Renaissance Europe, sugar was a spice, just like black pepper and cloves and other spices that they were importing from elsewhere were. And it's only the advent of commodity industrialized sugar production, very closely tied into the history of slavery, especially in the Caribbean, that sugar moved from a spice to a commodity. And so I think about spices in a more fluid way. We carry a few things that might not traditionally be considered a spice, but can very much be used as one. We have a really interesting black lime powder from Guatemala. It's a regular old green lime dried in the sun, actually in a similar process to the Urfa chili, the black Urfa chili, where the pepper turns black as it dries and develops these kind of mineral roasted notes. And then we grind it up into a powder. So it's a lime, but it's the whole fruit. You know, it's not just the juice, which is what most people are familiar with in cooking. So it's the skin, the pith, the pulp, dried and ground. And the drying process adds this extra dimension of flavor that's really spectacular. And dried black limes are a common ingredient in Persian and Iraqi cooking.
Yeah, I was about to say that. I think I've seen that in some of my Persian cookbooks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So that's one thing that we carry as a spice. Another thing that we're playing around with is kelp, seaweed from Iceland. There's a producer in northwest Iceland that harvests wild kelp beds. Their factory is on a geothermal vent, so their entire operation is carbon neutral. They harvest wild kelp from the ocean. It gets rinsed and dried and ground into a sort of a flake texture, sort of like a chili flake. And kelp is where MSG is extracted from. So there's tons of umami flavor in the kelp.
Nice, yeah.
It has some residual saltiness from being in the ocean, just the sea salt. And it's just got this great, sort of oceany, briny, mineral flavor that has been, I love and has been really popular.
Wow, you're really making me hungry with all of these flavors. So here's a question. You talked about working with chefs and supplying directly to restaurants, but are these also available just for home cooks?
Thank you for asking. Yes, they are. Our business is about half retail, half wholesale. So we do, we ship out hundreds or sometimes even thousands of orders a month to home cooks across the country. We have a lot of information on our website about where spices come from, how they're grown, and lots of recipe suggestions for spices that people may not have worked with before. Mm-hmm. And our website is burlapandbarrel.com.
Oh, that's awesome. I think I may have to put in an order because some of these especially after hearing about your black pepper. I love black pepper so much. It's probably the most common spice I use in my daily routine whenever I cook. And so finding things that have or finding ingredients that have those really rich lemony, maybe in some cases even like a pine-like twist to them. It really adds a special flavor to every dish.
Yeah.
It's really neat. Yeah, so absolutely. I guess, wow, I mean, you've had such a journey and so many adventures I can see with all these travels. What's been the most surprising thing that's happened along the way for you?
Oh, good question. I mean, I think what's really been most surprising is that anybody actually cares about what we're, about what we're doing. You know, I had this idea more than 5 years ago now. I have a lot of friends in the industry, and when I went to them with this original, very, very early stage, not well thought out concept, they all said, you know, I don't think anybody cares about this. Spices are spices. And you know, me being stubborn, I didn't listen to them. And I think the response that we've seen from professional chefs, that was less surprising. I knew they would appreciate the quality of the ingredient, but from home cooks, it was never really our plan to have that be a big part of the business. I didn't think that home cooks were going to care that much about where their black pepper came from, but it turns out thankfully I was wrong.
Yeah.
And they really do. And I think a lot of that, groundwork has been laid by the coffee industry. People understand that a coffee from Costa Rica might taste different from a coffee from Ethiopia. And that's something to celebrate rather than something to avoid. And we're seeing a similar change. You know, the coffee industry went from people buying big tubs of Folgers or chock full of nuts or something like that to now buying something single origin or being more thoughtful about where their coffee is from. And we're seeing that shift happen in the spice industry as well. People are going from buying anonymous bottles of cinnamon that have been sitting around forever to wanting to know the variety, wanting to know the species, wanting to know the country of origin. And understanding the effect that all of those factors have on flavor.
Yeah. Well, and I think where this falls in line so well with the main underlying concept of this podcast is how flavor is also tied to plant chemistry, which is clearly tied to this kind of food medicine continuum and this line between foods and medicine. And when you do have that richer flavor, it is indicative of the presence of more of those bioactive molecules that can impact our health. And spices, I actually teach a course on called Food, Health, and Society, and one of our upcoming lecturers is on the spice trade. So I'm super pumped that I was able to interview you before this lecture. I'll be able to add a little bit of extra new detail to it. But we talk about the long history of the spice trade, where you did have, you know, so many different hands that, you know, the spices passed through, and it took years to get them from one part of the world to the other. And the trade of spices actually really was a major source of economy and helped to spur global exploration in many ways. If you think about the spice routes and the silk routes and all these roads and networks that came from Asia through the Middle East, heading towards North Africa, and then eventually into Europe. The history there is just amazing. And again, they were using them not just for the enjoyment of their flavors, but as medicinal ingredients in many cases.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's, I mean, two points on the history of the spice trade that I think get overlooked. One is that, not surprisingly, there tends to be a Eurocentric view of the spice trade, spices being grown in other places to bring to Europe. But all throughout history, Europe was the smallest destination in terms of volume of spices that were being grown in India, in islands across the South Pacific, and what's now Indonesia. For every ship that took spices to Europe, there were a dozen ships taking spices to the Middle East or to China. So those trade routes have existed for a really long time, taking spices to places other than Europe.
Other than Europe, that's a really good point. Yeah.
And the other element of it is the thing that I find so fascinating about the history of the spice trade is that they're not a source of calories. It's not, you know, you look at the history of the salt trade, where salt is critical for human survival, critical for the preservation of food, critical for the domestication of animals and keeping livestock. But spices are not critical for really for anything. They taste good. They definitely have medicinal benefits. But ultimately, it's a luxury product. And to look at the lengths that people went to thousands of years ago, the distances they traveled, the personal risk that they put themselves through to source an ingredient that that was really just about making somebody happier.
Yeah.
It's just, I just love that. I love that aspect of it. It's so interesting that people were just willing to do all of that work for something that was ultimately sort of a luxury.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The search for those magical ingredients that's still something that spurs me when I travel. I mean, I'm looking primarily for medicinal plants used to treat infection, but believe me, when I'm there, I'm also tasting lots of interesting ingredients and always looking for new flavor experiences, both in herbal teas and also local spices that are used.
Yeah.
Yeah. This was just fascinating, Ethan. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been great to talk with you.
Developing sustainable direct sources for ingredients is so important, not only to the flavor and pharmacology of our spices, but also provides a great pathway to sustainable and equitable trade networks directly with farmers. I can't wait to give some of Ethan's spices a try. If you'd like to try them too, you can explore their product line and order individual spices or spice collections at www.burlapandbarrel.com. And that's spelled BURLAPANDBARREL.com. You can also follow their work at Burlap and Barrel on social media platforms. Ethan also has his own podcast. It's called Why Food, so be sure to give that one a listen as well. I'm Dr. Cassandra Quave, and you've been listening to Foodie Pharmacology, the science podcast for the food curious, recorded in Atlanta, Georgia at the Emory University Center for Digital Scholarship. You can subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, and do me a huge favor, leave me a rating there and maybe some comments. If you've got any great ideas for future episodes, please reach out to me on social media platforms, and I'll see you next time.